From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, crime novelist James Ellroy. He investigates a real murder in his memoir, My Dark Places, the murder of his own mother nearly 40 years ago. The book comes out in paperback next month. Also today, jazz musician Ellery Eskelin, who learned about his late father by listening to the records his father made. In the 60s, his father was a composer at a record company that set people's lyrics to music, people who responded to ads on the back of magazines. Now Eskelin's father is a cult figure to people who collect these records. And film critic John Powers reviews a new movie about misogyny called In the Company of Men. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. James Ellroy is a popular crime novelist whose obsession with crime dates back to his childhood. His mother was murdered, strangled to death, in 1958 when he was 10. Her body was discovered on the side of the road in a suburb of Los Angeles. Ellroy's parents were divorced. He was living with his father at the time of the murder. Ellroy wrote a memoir called My Dark Places about his mother's murder and the impact it had on his life. Ellroy's crime novels include The Black Dahlia, White Jazz, and American Tabloid. Next month, his book My Dark Places will be published in paperback, and a movie adaptation of his novel L.A. Confidential will be released. Ellroy still doesn't know who killed his mother, although he reopened the investigation with homicide detective Bill Stoner in 1994. The case remains unsolved. When Ellroy started investigating his mother's murder, he found a photograph in her files of the body, which he reprints in the book. I spoke with him last December and asked him to describe the photo.
My mother is lying face down in an ivy thicket on an access road adjoining Arroyo High School in El Monte, California. The date is June 22, 1958. Geneva Hilliker Ellroy was 43 years old at the time of her death. Her back is mottled with postmortem lividity. There are two ligatures lashed around her neck, the stocking taken off her left leg, and a clothesline cord.
How did you get this photograph?
I first saw them in 1994 when I was 46 years old in the office of the L.A. Sheriff's Homicide Bureau. I went there to see my mother's murder file and write a piece about it for the magazine GQ.
What impact did this photograph have on you coming decades after the actual murder?
Seeing the file and seeing the photographs of my mother dead, and I saw the file first and saw the photographs of her dead last that day, made me realize, oh, this isn't over. I had always understood the extent to which my mother's death had formed me intellectually, but now I could feel it in my bones.
Now, there's another picture that's of great interest in your new book, and it's a picture of you that was taken by a press photographer one day after your mother's murder. Would you describe that photograph?
The photograph was taken of me that same day, June 22, 1958. I had come back from spending the weekend with my father in Los Angeles, came back to the house where I lived with my mother in El Monte, a crummy small town 14 miles east of downtown L.A. Pulled up in a cab, there were uniformed men, cops, and plainclothesmen in the front yard, and I sensed immediately that she was dead. Cop took me aside and said, "Son, your mother's been killed. Where's your father?" I told him he was at the bus depot waiting to go back to L.A. A few minutes later, an L.A. Times photographer led me diagonally across the yard to my landlord's tool shed. He posed me at a woodworking bench with a woodworking awl in my hand and took several pictures of me.
Were you ever doing real woodwork at that
no,
bench?
No, I've never done woodwork in my life.
Was there anything authentic about that picture at all?
No.
It's so interesting to see it. You look like the all-American kid.
It's my life at ground zero. And as I say in the book, I am too lost in calculation or just plain dumbfounded thought to evince signs of simple grief.
Yeah, this photograph is taken on the day when you found out your mother was murdered.
Yes.
So it's not really registering on your face. How did it register on you that day?
I was happy. I hated my mother. I lusted for my mother. My parents were divorced. My father had been systematically poisoning my mind against my mother for the 3.5, 4 years since the divorce. At the time of her death, and I was 10 years old then, my one great wish was to live with my father exclusively, and on June 22nd, 1958, that wish came true.
Now, you were a little kid, and you were questioned by the cops.
Yes.
How did it feel as a kid to be questioned? And what did you think of cops? Did you think of them as, you know, cops were a kid's friend, or did you think of them as, did you have any predisposition toward cops?
I liked them. They were deferential to me.
Mm-hmm.
They were respectful. They may have been somewhat dumbfounded by the fact that I wasn't showing signs of grief
mm-hmm.
or evincing much emotion toward my mother, but they were nice. Cops questioned me, and they wanted to know about my mother's boyfriends, the men that she was seeing. And I had been predisposed by my father to think of my mother as a promiscuous drunk, and I told the cops she was a promiscuous drunk. I may have used the words, she was a drunk and a whore, which were the words that my father used to describe my mother since the divorce.
Did the cops ask you any questions that really set your imagination reeling?
They just asked about men, and it forced me to look back and recall the two times I found my mother in bed with strange men that I had never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
It got me living again in that poisonous world that my father created around my mother and her memory.
What impact did it have on you to walk in on your mother and a boyfriend?
It was shocking. It was almost horrifying. It was 1956 and 1957 when this occurred. I was 8 and 9 years old. I was a kid at the time. I was a kid going to Lutheran church. Sex was shocking. Sex was perverted. Sex was titillating. Sex was wonderful. I knew it was something to look forward to. I knew it was the big, bad, ugly, groovy thing that people giggled about and talked about and really wanted to do all the time.
Your mother's murder was sexually related. I wonder how that affected your sexual fantasies.
I was interested in sex early on. In My Dark Places, I describe my parents as a great-looking, cheap couple along the lines of Robert Mitchum and Jane Russell in Macau. They stayed together for 15 years. It had to be sex. They were sexual people. They didn't flaunt it in front of me, but it was there. I understood it early on as subtext and went crazy with it. That my mother died in the course of a horrific, probable rape, later a sex killing, only added to the texture of my fantasies.
Did you find yourself gravitating toward women who looked like your mother?
Yes.
And did that bother you? Did you think that that was odd? Or
I felt like I was working out my own sexual dynamic. I liked older women rather than girls my own age. I seized on another murdered woman from before my birth, Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. The Black Dahlia murder case is arguably America's most famous unsolved woman killing. I first read about Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia, in 1959. My father got me a book called The Badge by Jack Webb of Dragnet TV fame, and the book contained a haunting 10-page summary of the Black Dahlia murder case, and I went crazy with it. And Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia, became my stand-in for Geneva Hilliker Elroy. And again, this was my means of explicating everything pertaining to my mother's death.
Mm-hmm.
And not surprisingly, many years later, I wrote a novel called The Black Dahlia.
Yeah. Now, you write in your new book that you soaked up crackpot ideas wholesale, and you even became a neo-Nazi for a while. What was the attraction of extremist propaganda to you?
There was no essential attraction. I was an extremely youthful, stupid, callow, doofus iconoclast. The junior high school and high school I went to were 97% Jewish. The only way that I stood out is that I wasn't Jewish. Thus, I became a Nazi. As I said in the book, I was the poster boy for the If You Can't Love Me, Notice Me chapter in all child psychology textbooks. My wife says the funniest line in My Dark Places is this: most of my friends were Jewish and predisposed to distrust my Nazi shenanigans.
Right. So you were willing to become somebody utterly despicable in order to get attention?
I was a buffoon. I was a clown.
Well, being a neo-Nazi is not exactly a buffoon, though. That's becoming, you know, dangerous and hateful. Whether you really take those beliefs to heart or not, just the fact that you'd be mouthing them, you know, turns you into somebody despicable.
Yes, as a 14, 15, and 16-year-old. You have to look at me then, mm-hmm. as a kid, 6'3", 130 pounds, 50 pounds of it acne. My pant legs terminated several inches above my ankles. I was dangerous to myself only. I was an acquired taste that nobody ever acquired.
Do you think you ever stopped becoming dangerous to yourself only and started to become dangerous to other people too?
I was never dangerous. I was always incapable of perpetrating violence, even when I lived on the streets for years and broke into houses and sniffed women's undergarments and drank and used drugs and stole things out of stores. I was incapable of rolling drunks, and I could have done it and gotten away with it. I planned to do it one time and always faltered at the last second. I planned on doing it several times. I just couldn't do it.
You just didn't have it.
I couldn't be violent to another human being.
Why was part of your M.O. sniffing women's undergarments?
I wanted Hancock Park, and I wanted love, and I wanted families, and I wanted sex. I had lived on the edge of this affluence for a long time, with no family, with no sex, with no money. And I had friends, buddies that lived there, and I was obsessed with the sisters of a couple of these guys. And one night, it was very late in 1966, I broke into a friend's house. And I described this in My Dark Places. I bopped around there late at night. I went in through a dog access door. I got down on my back and reached one of my long, skinny arms and popped the latch on the door inside and opened it from the inside, scooted in, walked around, checked the medicine cabinets for some dope, found some pills to take, drank bourbon out of cut glass decanters, made myself a ham sandwich, filched a $10 bill out of a wallet, went up to a girl named Heidi's bedroom and sniffed her undies. And it was a way to be in a hermetically sealed, safe, affluent, sexual, family-derived inner world. And it fueled my imagination, and I did it and did it and did it. I went back to that house repeatedly, always covered my tracks, mm-hmm. never stole things that would be noticed, was very cautious, was very circumspect, did it at a place across the street, did it at several more places in Hancock Park, did it perhaps 20, 25 times total over about 3 years.
My guest is crime writer James Elroy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Elroy. His book about his mother's murder is called My Dark Places. How did you become involved in the reopening of your mother's murder case?
I saw my mother's murder file in March of 1994. She was 36 years dead at this time. I saw it because a friend of mine, a reporter, said that he was going to see the file as part of a piece he was doing on 5 unsolved San Gabriel Valley homicides, and I realized I had to see the file and write about it for GQ. I saw my mother's murder file. It was just as shocking and revelatory an experience as you'd think it would be. The man who showed me the file was a soon-to-retire L.A. Sheriff's homicide investigator named Bill Stoner. He had nothing to do with my mother's case and, in fact, wasn't even a cop in 1958. He impressed me greatly. I saw my mother's murder file. It was like a gear clicked in my head, and it was like the little gear had a voice that said, oh, now you know. Now you can't go back.
How did the reopening of your mother's murder case change your feelings about your mother?
To begin with, I started to see that I came directly out of her. My mother, Geneva Hilliker Elroy, had a strong profligate side. She was alcoholic. She liked cheap men. Well, I had a strong profligate side. I was a housebreaking misanthrope, an alcoholic, and a drug addict, but I was able to clean up. And she never had that chance. She had a puritanical, Midwestern Protestant, hard case streak that I developed later in life. I began to see how much gender bias favored me. My mother was murdered back in 1958, and she was a woman. I was able to drink and use drugs and whore to a far greater degree than she ever probably could have or probably even imagined in the 1970s, and I was a man, and all of this was condoned by society.
You know what I found really interesting? You used to assume that your mother was raped by her murderer because there was evidence that sex had occurred right before she was murdered.
Yes.
But after reopening the investigation, you and the detective investigating the case, Bill Stoner, concluded that she had consensual sex with her killer, that they were most likely, you know, making love before she was murdered.
We've actually gone back and forth on it.
Oh, okay.
Quite a few times.
So you're not convinced that it was consensual?
No, Stoner's most recent perspective is that it was a date rape and that occurred on the grounds at a Royal High School.
Mm-hmm.
I initially, in my GQ piece, came to the conclusion that it was consensual sex. Stoner and I have been over the two nights, June 21st, 1958, June 22nd of 58. A million times, hypothetically. We've analyzed the evidence. We have gone over it with a fine-tooth comb. And in the end, we haven't been able to make a judgment.
Mm-hmm. You still haven't found your mother's murderer. The case remains unsolved.
Right.
Do you have any theories?
Yes. I'll tell everybody out there in radio land the physical facts of the case and then extrapolate a little bit. I spent the weekend with my father in the city of Los Angeles. My mother remained in El Monte. She left the house between 8 and 8:30 Saturday night. She was seen poking her head into Mamma Mia's Pizza there in the Five Point section of El Monte around 9 o'clock. It looked like she was looking for somebody. She was seen alone at a bar called The Manger between 9 and 9:30. She was seen in a 55 or 56 Oldsmobile at Stan's Drive-In Restaurant around 10:15 with a dark-haired, swarthy white man. She was seen an hour later with the dark-haired, swarthy white man and a blonde woman at the Desert Inn Bar, six blocks from Stan's Drive-In. At 2:30 in the morning, she was seen back at the same drive-in, waited on by the same car hop with just the swarthy man, and her body was found on the grounds at a Royal High School at 10:10 the next morning. On her second trip to Stan's Drive-In, her top was slightly unbuttoned and one of her breasts was half exposed. She was giddy. The swarthy man looked sullen. He was being uncommunicative. It was the car hop that told sheriff's detectives this. Initially, I had thought that they had made love between the visit to the Desert Inn where they were seen with the blonde woman and the second trip to Stan's Drive-In, that my mother wanted more from this man, more love, more sex, more affection, more male attention, and that the swarthy man had gotten what he wanted and wanted to ditch this desperate woman and get on with his life. The conflagration occurred because she wanted more. I thought that when I wrote the GQ piece, and it made me love my mother fiercely because wanting more has been, in many ways, the subject of my life. More love, more recognition, more literary glory, more of the ability to write profound books. More, more, more. This is me, James Elroy, coming out of Geneva Hilliker Elroy, the murder victim, the farm girl from Tunnel City, Wisconsin. When Stoner and I began the actual hard reinvestigation of my mother's murder, Stoner took me aside and said, I have to tell you what I think happened, and I have to be very blunt. He proceeded to lay out the scenario of a last-second, horrible, ugly date rape with my mother unconscious, hit in the head, perhaps with the swarthy man's fist, perhaps with a lug wrench, and it all went down right there on the access road, which was a lover's lane beside Arroyo High School. Parenthetically, Stoner has also said, you can't lock yourself into any hypothesis. You always have to remain open to new theories, and you have to remain open to the prospect that new evidence will blow out everything that you've thought before.
I wonder what it's like for you. I'm sure you're giving a lot of interviews about your new book and about your mother's murder, and it's a subject you've actually spoken about already for several years. And so, in some ways, your mother's death, the kind of centerpiece of your life in some ways, you know, the event that most shaped you, is it's a book in a way, it's a performance too, because it's something that you've had to talk about publicly for a long time. So in a way, you're immersed in it and yet constantly distancing yourself from it by packaging it in a way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. She's with me now. I think about her continually. I discuss my mother with my wife, and my wife is easily the single most brilliant human being that I've ever met. We talk about my mother. I see my mother's face. I can smell her. I swear I can smell her from 38 years back. I think about her. I've had a lot of thrills as a writer. Nothing comes close to giving my mother to the world. I think it's ironic that she was such a private woman. She had an imperious quality to her. She had a charisma. She drew people to her. She was a handsome woman. She possessed, as I say in the book, a severe and breathtakingly implacable beauty. I want to crash the mask of that beauty. I want to know her. Thus, she's with me continually. Thus, I think it's ironic that, to an extent, I robbed her grave. I invaded her hidden time and gave her to the world because it was the only gift of love that I could give her.
Well, James Elroy, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Jerry, it was my pleasure.
James Elroy's book about his mother's murder is called My Dark Places. It will be published in paperback next month to coincide with the movie adaptation of his novel, L.A. Confidential. Here's the movie's theme, composed by Jerry Goldsmith. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to a recording by saxophonist Ellery Eskelin. Coming up, some incredibly strange songs composed by his late father. And film critic John Powers reviews In the Company of Men about two men seeking revenge against women. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You know those ads in the back of magazines that said, send us your lyrics and we'll set them to music? Don't you wonder what the results sounded like? Well, Ellery Eskelin recently found out that his late father, Rod Keith, was one of the composers who was hired to set those lyrics to music, then perform and record the songs. These unusual records, now collector's items, are some of the best clues Eskelin has about his father's life. Ellery Eskelin's parents divorced shortly after he was born, and his father died in a mysterious accident or suicide when Eskelin was a child. Nevertheless, Eskelin has kind of followed in his father's footsteps. He's a composer and saxophonist, but the music he plays is jazz and free improvisation. Recently, Ellery Eskelin compiled a CD collecting some of his father's songs. The CD is called I Die Today. When I spoke with Eskelin last December, I asked him to describe his father's music.
It's called song poem music, and I consider it a genre unto itself. It's the result of those ads that people have probably seen in the backs of magazines in which companies solicit the public to send in their lyrics. Their lyrics then get the full studio treatment by Hollywood's finest, set to music and recorded, and with that you're on your way to fame and stardom.
So the idea is you write a poem, you write a lyric, you mail it in, and for a fee, the composers who work for this company will set it to music and give
exactly.
you a studio recording of it.
Exactly.
So your father would crank out up to 30 melodies a day for these lyrics.
Yeah, he was a very gifted musician, and he was able to do this kind of work very easily. It was sort of his, I guess you might call it a day job, in as much it was his means to make a living while he pursued, I'm not quite sure what else he pursued, but this is what we have left.
Why don't we hear the title track of the new record that you've produced, mm-hmm. of the songs that your father did while working for one of these companies. Actually, while working for several of these companies.
Mm-hmm.
And the title track is called I Died Today. Tell us what you know or what you find interesting about this track before we hear it.
It's simply one of many records that I recently came across. My uncle, Gerald Eskelin, who is an active musician in Los Angeles, Rod's brother, has been keeping a box of records over the many years, and I recently found them. And this was one of them. I don't really know what to make of it. When I sit back and think about the person who must have sent these lyrics in, it's sort of chilling on the one hand, or maybe it's just someone's imaginative take. I'm not sure what their intent was in this being a hit record, but it's one of my favorites.
Well, let's hear the title track of I Died Today, the anthology that you put together of your father's songs, the melodies that he created for other people's lyrics. And we'll hear your father, Rod Keith, singing and at the keyboard.
It was a dark and a rainy night. My headlights were really too bright. I was thinking of my kids and of my darling wife. My sales were down, my pay was small, and I needed money bad. I couldn't pay the mortgage to even keep the things we had. Then through the night there came a light, a hobo wanted a ride. I brought my old car to a stop, and he got in by my side. We continued on, just we two. His presence seemed to calm my nerves, but the road was wet and my vision blurred. And I didn't see the curve. When I awoke, I saw the flames and the people through the trees. I knew from their conversation They thought the hobo was me.
That's I Die Today, the title track of a new collection that was produced by my guest, Ellery Eskelin. And Ellery's father, Rod Keith, wrote the melody to the song we heard. It was also his voice that we heard. He was at the keyboards. And he was basically paid by this music house to set lyrics that were sent in through the mail, to set those lyrics to music. Now, your father was sent lyrics that were supposed to fit into every genre. So he had to write songs around every genre: dance crazes, novelties, romantic ballads, patriotic anthems. Right. Let's hear one of the kind of hippie dance tunes that he did. This is something called Hippie Happy Land.
Right.
And again, he's singing, and I guess on keyboards. Anything that you know about this song, or any feelings that you have about it?
Again, just that I'm just, as is the case with most of these songs, you know, they're just sort of just what they are. But I think Rod really brings to each one a surprising little twist, or just a little bit more than you might expect from these proceedings, if you will. When you listen to the words, sometimes they can be funny or even a little inane. But he really brings himself to it with a lot of vigor and 100% of himself, even if it might be a little tongue-in-cheek. And, you know, that's certainly the case with this one.
Let's hear it. This is Hippie Happy Land. I think if I was a composer and I was sent those lyrics to put to music, I just wanted, you know, I just kind of call it quits. I would be in such despair. I mean, you must often ask yourself, what was your father's frame of mind when he was getting all these inane lyrics?
It's a very intriguing thought, because the more of these pieces I hear, the more I really appreciate that. They're really from the entire spectrum of pop music, plus a lot of hybrids that I think he created himself due to these lyrics.
My guest is jazz musician Ellery Eskelin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is jazz composer and musician Ellery Eskelin. He's compiled a CD of his father's songs, songs he wrote around lyrics mailed in by the public in response to ads in the back of magazines saying, "Send us your lyrics and we'll make them into songs." Now, you never really knew your father. Your parents separated when you were very young.
Yeah.
And your father stayed in Los Angeles. You and your parents moved to Baltimore, I believe?
Mm-hmm. That's where my mother is originally from.
So, in a way, I mean, the only information you have about your father is what relatives have told you and what you've heard from these records. Have these records changed your idea of who your father was?
I guess they haven't changed it so much. I think they represent an accurate, if only partial, picture of who he was. When I was growing up, I was told many, many stories of my father's talent and talent and idiosyncrasies. He was described as being quite the charming eccentric. And as I became serious about music myself and began playing saxophone at age 10, these stories really started to have a profound effect on me. Unfortunately, Rod died in 1974, very tragically, and before I ever had a chance to really make his acquaintance or communicate with him in much of any way, it was over. So I've had these stories as part of my life now. I'm 37, and this music has recently come to my attention only in the last maybe 2 years. I was aware that Rod did this kind of stuff, and I had even heard a few examples when I was a teenager, and at the time I wasn't that impressed because it just didn't seem to sort of coincide with the sort of genius that everyone had been talking about. But now that I've heard so many of them and I can put them in a context of just exactly what the nature of the business was and just imagine what it must have taken to be able to accomplish the task, I'm actually quite impressed. He has had to have been quite an imaginative guy.
Well, as I said before, he wrote in all kinds of genres, novelty dance tunes like mm-hmm. Do the Pig and Do the Turkey, and,
right.
and romantic ballads. There's even a patriotic number, a patriotic anthem mm-hmm. that you have on the new record called I Am a Real American. Mm-hmm. And for listeners just joining us again, my guest is Ellery Eskelin, and he's a jazz musician. His father, who died in 1974, specialized in setting other people's lyrics to music. And he basically worked at a house where this is what they did. They advertised on the backs of magazines and asked people to send in their poems and lyrics, and they tell you professional musicians would set it to music and mail the results back to you. So here's one of the results. This is a lyric that was mailed to your father. I am a real American, and we'll hear your father doing the voice on this.
First of all, allow me to make myself perfectly clear. Dear Lord, help us to love each other instead of fear. I believe in the Constitution of the USA. I respect the Holy Bible, every word it says. I believe in human rights, regardless of color. And I will not allow myself to mislead others. My utmost aim in life is to love and respect my wife. My family, neighbors, love them all as one, for this God gave his only son. I believe utmost in integrity and unity. Educational equality with divine obligation.
Are these records the only times that you've heard your father's voice?
Yes, they are. They are.
Your father was such the mystery man in a way. I mean, you never really knew him because he died when you were young.
Right.
The music that we have of his is these melodies that he set to other people's lyrics. He even died in a really mysterious way. In fact, you've printed a copy of the obituary, so I think mm-hmm. I'll read it. It says, this was December of 1974. Leaping or falling from an overcrossing onto the Hollywood freeway, a man identified as Rodney Eskelin, 37, address unknown, was struck by numerous cars and killed. Police said the victim plunged down the Santa Monica Boulevard overpass onto the northbound freeway at about 5:10 a.m., and drivers could not avoid him. Does your family have any clues about whether this was an accident or suicide?
I guess there are clues either way, and at this point it seems to be equally divided. I've never met anyone or I've met very few people, let's put it that way, who have a definitive opinion one way or another, and it seems that the best that anybody can come up with is that it could have been either. It could have just as easily been an accident, or it could have just as easily been intentional. But that's been another very profound aspect of this story for me, just because of the circumstances of his life, especially in the last few years. He was very much into hallucinogens, almost in a religious, mystical kind of way. I think he had a very naive curiosity towards spiritual matters. You have to remember that he comes from a very strong religious background, which he then sort of rejected, at least in as much as the formal part of it, the church itself, although I think he retained a very deep spiritual feeling, and drugs came into his life, and I think he integrated that into who he was. And so a lot of what he was trying to do, or what he thought he was trying to do, might have been an experimentation or a flirtation with life on the other side. On the other hand, it could have very well been a very careless act. He was known to walk on high balconies just to sort of freak people out.
You think he might have been manic depressive?
That's a theory of one of Rod's close friends from the end of his life. Yeah, she, in retrospect, seems to recognize some of those attributes. At the time, I don't think people quite knew, or maybe they did, but she was very young at the time, and I think now she has a strong feeling that he may have been. It may have been something that was exacerbated by constant drug use, or it may have been something that he was trying to self-medicate against. I can't truly say.
You know, if your father was depressive and prone to suicide, if this really was a suicide, then I can't help but think what it must have been like for him to always have to set to music, lyrics written, one would imagine, by often lonely, not very talented people. I mean, that could be a really depressing experience.
I agree with you. I mean, he did this for a long time. I understand that he was frustrated that he couldn't seem to find more legitimate work, but then, from what I know, his lifestyle became more and more avant-garde, in as much as he just was sort of undependable. And even the people who were closest to him towards the end found it harder and harder to even deal with him. He was just not showing up on time. Sessions were late or delayed. He would just drop off the face of the earth for days or weeks at a time. So that right there, I think, interfered with his any plans or aspirations he might have had to make it in the larger music world.
Your mother told you that before your parents separated, your father would play music for you when you were, 2 years old or something. He'd play his favorite progressive jazz records for you. Any
right.
idea of what those records were that he'd play for you when you were very, very young?
Well, he liked jazz. Jazz was his favorite music at the time. My mother plays Hammond B3 organ, and they had a duet, and they played music together. And she tells me that they played a lot of things, but jazz is his sort of love. I know he liked the Four Freshmen and other things at that time. The only record that I can ascertained for certain was played in my crib was Stan Kenton's City of Glass. And I heard about this record all my life. Whenever anybody wanted to sort of allude to the most far-out thing they could think of, it was invariably Stan Kenton's City of Glass. And my mother was just sure that Rod was going to frighten me with this music, that I was too young, and that it frightened her. And so it's ironic, because I never did really get to hear that piece of music until recently. I think it was just reissued on CD, and I've always been a big Stan Kenton fan myself. And I finally got that music some months ago and listened to it, and I was pretty impressed. I think it was written in sometime in the 50s, and at that time especially, I'm sure that it really just was the end to most people.
Now, do you think that those records that your father played for you when you were in your crib helped develop your ear and interest in music?
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, I guess, honestly, I can't really say for sure, but it's a very attractive idea, isn't it? I think it's something that I've always kind of held special, because it's one of the few ways that I can say I really had a contact with my father.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from that, the only other one was indirectly through my grandmother, Rod's mother, She began writing us letters when I was around 13 or 14 years old and sort of, you know, making the connection between the families again. And there was plans of sending me out to visit and meet Rod. And I guess I had sent her a letter, and I told her all about my love of the saxophone and what I was doing. And she wrote me back saying that she had showed the letter to Rod and that he had said that he was proud of my talent in the music field. And, you know, I look back at that as being maybe the only sliver of communication, you know, besides those records in my room when I was 1.5 years old that I still have to hold, you know, dear to my heart. And, you know, I really do.
Ellery Eskelin's collection of his father's songs is called I Died Today, Music of Rod Keith. It's on the Zodiac record label. Next month, Ellery Eskelin will have a new CD of his own called One Great Day. Here's music from one of Ellery's earlier CDs, The Sun Died. Coming up, a new film about men who want revenge against women. This is Fresh Air. The ideal Hollywood movie is designed to leave everyone feeling the same way. Not so with Independence. One such new low-budget film that has already left audiences disagreeing is In the Company of Men. Our film critic John Powers first saw the film at this year's Sundance Festival and has this review.
The great advantage of making movies on a shoestring is that you're free. Free to tackle tricky material, free to adopt a weird style, free to offend the audience. Made for a piddling $25,000, In the Company of Men does all of these things. It's a genuine provocation. The movie centers on two businessmen. There's handsome, dimple-chinned Chad, wonderfully played by Aaron Eckert, and there's his superior Howard, played by Matt Malloy, who's both kinder-seeming and dweebier than Chad. When we first see them, they're heading off on a 6-week trip to a branch office. Both are frustrated by work, and more important, they're angry at having just been dumped by their girlfriends. And so Chad proposes a scheme that will let them take revenge on women. The two will find some lonely woman who's not used to being courted, and they'll overwhelm her with affection until she feels loved by them both. Then they'll suddenly dump her and laugh all the way home. Howard agrees to this plan, and the two men start wooing their chosen victim, a lovely deaf secretary named Christine, who's played by Stacey Edwards. This demonic tale was written and directed by newcomer Neil LaBute, a 34-year-old playwright whose previous work has all been for the theater. Although In the Company of Men is not a filmed play, LaBute's style carries a strong whiff of the proscenium arch. He pushes his story forward with flurries of macho, mammoth-style dialogue, and he gives everything a stylized look. Chad and Howard are defined by their white shirts and ties, just as their lives are defined by the neutral spaces they inhabit, airport lounges, office cubicles, restaurants with no personality. These aren't realistic characters. They're stencils, whose monstrous ways of thinking are revealed by their soaring cadences of spite and their chortling relish in their own viciousness.
He's John Merrick. It's the only thing I can think of the whole time. I'm sitting across from the f***ing elephant man.
But she's attractive, though, right?
Yeah, I guess. Yes, I would say, yeah.
Tall?
Kind of average. But you should see her going at it, working to put the simplest sounds together.
Oh.
I mean, an A-E-I-O-U, sometimes Y, is like the holy grail to this poor wretch. After about 15 minutes, I can't watch any more saliva form the corner of her mouth or I'm going to lose my taco salad. I mean it.
Was she nice? I mean...
Nice? Yeah, sweet, giving, all those things.
That's good.
In fact, one of the kindest people I've ever had spray spit in my face.
Last week, I mentioned that the strongest thing about Air Force One was its catchy premise. The same is true of In the Company of Men. Chad and Howard's decision to single out a frail, innocent woman and then shatter her is the most viscerally compelling hook of any movie this year. You simply have to know what's going to happen next, even as some of the scenes become so painful that you want to avert your eyes. LeBute makes us feel the true weight of human heartlessness, and he doesn't stop there. He suggests that the male capacity for cruelty is intensified by the very nature of corporate competition. Chad and Howard, after all, work for a company of men. Because the movie was made on the cheap, the lighting is ugly, the acting's uneven, and the boom dangles into the frame. But these are the kind of flaws that you have to forgive in a low-budget picture. What's harder to forgive are the lapses in overall vision. Despite himself, LeBute seems enthralled by Chad and Howard's meanness and by his own ability to shock us. He turns some of the most vicious remarks into laugh lines. And attempting to give the movie a wicked edge, he sometimes pushes too hard, as when Chad humiliates a black employee by making him show his private parts in his office. When the movie premiered at Sundance, it left audiences wildly, even angrily, divided. Viewers who hated the film were often mocked for being PC, for not grasping that Chad and Howard's offensive behavior wasn't being celebrated, but dissected. But what bothers me about the film is not that it isn't PC, but that it is. Although the misogynist dialogue makes it sound as if LeBute's boldly violating taboos, he's actually serving up just another one-dimensional look at the flawed psyche of white men, especially white men in corporate culture. What could be more politically correct? In the Company of Men may hold us in its clutches from beginning to end, but its bleak picture of the American male psyche is the stuff of shop-worn slogans, not cutting-edge art. This is one movie that manages to make men seem even worse than we actually are.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, welcome back Audrey, Fred Snyder, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Frances Yu is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.